It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. More and more people in the U.S. are demanding better food options and to know what is in the food that they're eating. Groups like Weight Watchers base their daily recommendations on the numbers you find on the backs of food labels. But how do we know what those food labels mean? Becky Kirkenbush is here to help us understand. She's a clinical dietitian at Watertown Regional Medical Center and media representative for the Wisconsin Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Becky, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, let's take us through this nutrition label. There's a lot of information on here. What are the big things that we should pay attention to on this food label?
Sure. So a food label can be really informative and help you make healthful decisions on what you're eating. Thankfully, it's listed in order from top to bottom on what we should really pay attention to. I tell people to start at the top and check the serving size. And then the number of serving in the package. Because serving size, all the information is listed for one serving. However, if the package has multiple servings and you eat two or three, then you need to multiply the information on there, such as calories or total fat.
And people do that all the time. They take a package and they eat the package thinking that that's one serving.
Exactly. And the newer food labels, they've gone through a nice update, have the calories listed in bold now to draw your eye to that.
Okay, good. So talk to me about this percent daily value. Daily value of what?
Sure. The percent daily value is, it's based on a 2,000 calorie diet, which, you know, the average American should be aiming for. Now, we certainly have a issue with eating more than 2,000 calories. But the percent daily value is basically what the nutrients we should be aiming for, the amount of that nutrient. So total fat, cholesterol, sodium, those are the things that we should be paying attention for and aiming for less, whereas items that we want more of would be potassium or vitamin D or dietary fiber. So it's a way of gauging how much you're getting and should you be aiming for more or less of a nutrient.
Okay, so what is the difference between saturated fat and trans fat?
So both fats are fats that we want to limit or avoid. Trans fats now, they are artificial fats and unhealthy. They affect our bad cholesterol by raising it. They are generally not recognized as safe anymore, and they are taken out of the food system. Saturated fat is a natural fat, so we can't eliminate it altogether. However, we can certainly decrease the amount that we eat and replace it with more healthful fat. So saturated fat is solid at room temperature. We find it in a lot of meat or animal products.
Mm-hmm. So there, trans fat is not included as percent daily value. Is that because we don't want it? There
exactly.
Is no percent daily value daily that is valuable to us at all?
Right, correct. There is no research. There are no recommended amounts or guidelines that could even have a value, so it's not listed.
So here's my question, though. I'm buying lots of different things at the store. I may have just picked up a hamburger on my way in because I was really hungry, and I don't necessarily know what was in that hamburger, you know, what the percent daily value of anything was in that hamburger, and I'm trying to figure out what to have for dinner to serve my kids this nutritious meal. It's like putting a puzzle together to look at all these food labels and figure out, I'm getting a percent, this percent daily value from this and this percent daily value from that. How hard is this? I know that this is why people just kind of give up on these kind of things.
So what I tell people is, if you're looking at the percent daily value, 5% or below is low, which would be a good thing for total fat, cholesterol, and sodium. 20% or more is considered high, which would be beneficial for things like fiber, potassium, total carbohydrates, vitamin D. You can also use what we call the My Plate method, which would be looking at your dinner plate when you're thinking about how you want to plan your meal. Make a quarter of that plate a lean, healthy protein. Make half that plate different vegetables, and then the other quarter of your plate being a starch, preferably a whole grain like brown rice, whole wheat pasta.
Not French fries.
Correct. So really, it doesn't have to be complicated or something that you worry about and analyze and fret over.
So, and does this vegetable on your plate, does it have to be green? There are arguments about this.
Oh, no. And actually, the more variety, the better, because each color in a vegetable or food item would be a different vitamin or mineral. So we do want, I say, a rainbow of color when you're eating vegetables and fruits.
Okay, so sugar doesn't include a percent daily value at all. Why not?
Well, the sugar listed on the food label is considered part of the total carbohydrates that's there, and so is the fiber. So when it comes to sugar, they now on the new food label have added sugar listed, which is more important, and I tell people to look at even more. There are natural sugars in fruit and dairy products, but the added sugar is what we should be most concerned about. That would be the type that you find in regular soda or in cakes or cookies or desserts. And sometimes even the added sugar in yogurt. You think you're making a healthy choice by eating a yogurt and not realizing that there are differences between different yogurts. So I tell people, use a food label to compare items, like your plain Greek yogurt versus a fruited yogurt.
Ah.
And you'll see where the added sugar is.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's my yogurt. the food labels on yogurt and the added sugar labels, are they on everything right now, or is that change happening gradually?
They should be on everything. If you look at your food labels right now, they should be very standardized. Things should be listed in the same order, include the same amount of information to make it easier for consumers.
So how did this new label come about?
Well, food labels were first published in the 90s, where fat was the biggest concern. And then over time, we do have the dietary guidelines from 2015 to 2020. That's how the food labels are kind of based off of, would be those new guidelines and what we're focusing on, which is now the added sugars and the sodium. So that's why they've included those changes in the food label.
I'm reading a food label and it says something like low sodium. Does that mean that there's low sodium in it?
Right. So low sodium is an actual label. It has to be 140 milligrams of sodium or less. So there are some of the claims that we do need to pay attention to. They do have value to those. Now on the front of a food label, it could say no sugar. It doesn't exactly mean that it'd be low in sodium or calorie free. So I always tell people, flip to the back and read the back of the food label. It's just as important as the front.
Probably more important than the front. So what are the things that people miss when they're reading these food labels?
Well, I think that they miss probably the fiber. Most Americans don't eat enough fiber. We should aim for 25 grams a day, but if you're not eating the fruits and vegetables and whole grains that are recommended, then you're falling short. The other thing would be the sugars. I think people get wrapped up in carbohydrates and trying to decrease those because of all the low-carbohydrate diets.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, carbohydrates aren't the villain that we need to avoid. It's more or less the added sugars because they come, of course, with added calories.
And added sugars come in soft drinks. They also come in alcoholic drinks.
That is correct. They do. And calories in alcohol per gram are about 9 calories per gram of alcohol. So that's more than you would find in your protein and your carbohydrates.
So in the last 30 seconds here, people may not always have measuring cups. How else can we estimate the serving size?
Sure. So the size of a deck of cards would be appropriate for chicken or beef.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, 3 ounces, so the size of a checkbook, if people still use those, would be the size of fish. And then just using your hand, if you close a fist, that's about 1 cup or appropriate size of a fresh fruit.
Becky Kirkenbusch is a clinical dietitian at Watertown Regional Medical Center. She has taken us through the new food labels. Thanks for being with us, Becky.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be talking about social media shaming in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It seems like it happens every other day. A video surfaces on social media showing someone screaming at a sales clerk. It goes viral. A distasteful tweet someone made from 2014 gets dug up and it blows up online. A photo of someone doing something disrespectful at a cemetery is posted on social media and the internet becomes outraged. A recent Stanford study found that rather than spur change, people end up feeling bad for people who are bombarded with negative online comments over questionable behavior. So why do we shame people online? And how are we defining questionable behavior? With us for the rest of the hour are two women who wrote a book on internet shaming. Sue Sheff is a speaker and internet safety advocate. Melissa Shore is a journalist. The two co-authored the book Shame Nation, The Global Epidemic of Online Hate. Sue and Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We are taking your calls on this for the rest of the hour also, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Sue, I want to hear from you first. You actually got into this because you became the victim of someone's online wrath while you were working as a children's services referral provider. Talk to me about that.
Well, it goes all the way back to 2003, believe it or not, when I won. Well, I won the internet one of the landmark internet defamation cases in 2006. When in 2003, I was attacked by a woman who had a vendetta against me. Yes, and I was completely destroyed online. And back then, we didn't even have the word cyberbullying. And I'm not sure if I even called it shaming back then, but I was completely humiliated and destroyed that when you put my name into that Google box. What came up was the most horrid things, like Sue Sheff is a fraud, I was a child abuser, I was a crook, I kidnapped kids. Not very good for someone who, in my real-life job, is an educational consultant helping families place kids into residential treatment centers. Mm. So I learned firsthand, you know, way back over a decade ago, what online shaming and humiliation was all about. And although my lawyer had vindicated me, it wasn't until I hired an online reputation management company that I truly had my life back and was able to go back and become financially sound and emotionally stable again. It took a long time.
Wow. So what did this reputation company do for you?
Well, it's Reputation Defender. They were actually the pioneer. I was very fortunate because I did win the case in September of 2006, and there was no such thing as ORM, which is Online Reputation Management. And they happened to open up their company back then. It's called Reputation.com now. What they did is they went out there, and they can't take any of this stuff down. What they do is they start building you back up again and start putting out all good things about you. And it's why I preach and talk and advocate about building not only your online reputation, but about rethinking and remodeling your online behavior. Because all of us out there go out there with good intentions. But like what you're seeing with people when they aim and shame or post in haste, we say, they don't think about what they're posting. We have to rethink not only about what we share, but how we share it. Because all of it, online reputation, online behavior go hand in hand, and they are a reflection of your character offline. And now it's causing people to not only prevent them from getting jobs, but they can also cost you your job.
Right. Your lawyer said that this case that you won showed that there was a limit to the material people could post about other people online. You won this case in 2006. I haven't seen any limitations since then.
No. Well, internet defamation is really, really hard to prove. And that's why when people come to me, and I've been bombarded with emails ever since, and I still do today, how people want to file a case against a perpetrator. You have to quantify your damages. And what happened with me is I had psychologists that would come forward and say to me, hey, listen, I haven't been able to refer clients to you. I wasn't able to get clients anymore because the minute they put my name into the Google box, they weren't going to hire me. So it totally impacted my financial. I could quantify my damages. And that's what people have to do with defamation today. You know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how to legally describe it. But all I can say to people out there is when you're being defamed, you have to quantify your damages. And there's also the emotional end of it, which, you know, obviously I had to shut down my office. Obviously, I was no longer generating any type of income or anything. It literally destroyed me. What was really interesting is after my story came out, and it made national and international news when I won this $11.3 million case, I had people from all walks of life, from other lawyers, doctors, dog groomers, teachers, principals, emailing me of their stories of how, people have gone out and destroyed them with their keystrokes. So it wasn't, and this back in 2006, and it was like a little tiny, no one talked about it. Today, we're talking about, we see it every day.
Right. This $11.3 million, did you get any of it?
We did settle in 2012. I got a portion of it. Certainly not $11.3 million, but I did get a portion of it.
Okay. You've got a lot of research online, Melissa, on shaming culture. Tell us what shaming culture is.
Well, I mean, I think what Sue is pointing to, you know, when she had this happen to her, we didn't even have social media, right?
Right.
And the ability to share. And
Facebook
and
did not come along until 2007.
Really? Right. Yeah. And so it's just exploded since then. I mean, we talk about the ability to really destroy someone's reputation. And now, you know, we've always had shaming, right? Going back to the days of the stocks where people were publicly shamed in the square. But now, you know, once your reputation is linked to your name and your image and put online, it's out there, it's permanent, it's international, it's forever. And it's very, very hard to ever go back from that. And, you know, one really interesting thing that we've seen is this sense of people shaming others for this sense of making themselves feel better. It's almost a virtue signaling. If I shame you for being a bad parent, you know, because you didn't watch your kid and then that kid fell into a gorilla pit, well, that means I would never do that thing. I'm a better parent than you. And I think a lot of shaming comes down to trying to make others feel lesser than so that, you know, the person posting can feel a little bit better about themselves and signal to their audience that they're better as well.
I should correct myself here. Facebook actually existed in 2004, but it didn't become public. It didn't go out of colleges until 2007. So why is it, let's dig into this a little bit, that we really, really want to shame? Is it that there's a remove now? I mean, would you walk up to somebody and shame them in the same way you would do it on Twitter?
Absolutely not. And what researchers call this is the online disinhibition effect, but basically what it means is when you're on the internet, you know, there's the anonymity very often. You know, you're posting under a screen name. There's the distance. You don't have to say that thing to that person in real life. There's no consequences. What's going to really happen to you? It's very unlikely you're going to get sued, and there's actually legal protections that the person, you know, the platform can't be held liable, so they don't have an incentive to really stop this. And there's just, you know, the gatekeepers are just not doing anything to stop it.
So at one point, this type of shaming was reserved for celebrities, public figures. It was considered that the price that they paid for being a public figure. Is that shifting now?
Absolutely. Now it's all of us. As we saw, you know, even just last week with the plane romance where started tweeting the couple in front of her's light flirtatious chat on the airplane. We actually started our book with, you know, people like that story because it was romance, it was nice. What people forget is that we started off our book with a very similar anecdote, but in the reverse. This was a couple on a plane breaking up, and a fellow passenger who we ended up talking to after this decided to again live tweet the woman and the man going through a huge fight on the plane and the woman's crying and all the conversation they had. And, you know, that wasn't such a happy moment. And I don't think that that couple really appreciated having their personal drama being displayed everywhere.
And the budding romance on the plane that happened a few weeks ago, the woman who was part of that conversation that was being live tweeted, she didn't appreciate it. She was kind of pissed afterwards.
Yeah. She was. And I think what we realize is that, you know, that's what we talk about in the book. This can happen to anyone at any time. You know, Sue is right. So much of this is, you know, you can prevent it if you're careful about what you post out there. And a lot of shaming comes down to people making a careless mistake and posting a picture they shouldn't have or saying something they shouldn't have online. But a lot of it now we've seen over and over is cases where, you know, someone's out and about minding their own business or, you know, maybe they get a little upset at a clerk at the store and suddenly people are whipping out their phones and filming them and it's all over for their reputation.
So I want to kind of dig, we have a couple of minutes before break, but I want to dig into what is it about our society that we've always done this? We've always built up celebrities or built people up and then gleefully tear them down. Where does that gleefully come from? Melissa?
What do you think, Sue?
Sue?
You've seen it first.
Why are they gleefully?
Yeah, like why is this so much a part of who we are that we want to tear people down and we have fun doing it?
Well, I think a lot is exactly what Melissa says. It gives us gratification. It makes us feel better than them. you know, the internet basically is the ultimate equalizer, and we can all feel equal on the internet until someone goes out there and takes us down with the keystrokes. Our keystrokes can be used for four reasons, whether to help, whether to harm, or whether to heal, or whether to hurt somebody, and it's totally up to us. And we have that power from behind the screen. Why do we do it? Because we can empower ourselves. A lot of people that are feeling less than go out there and feel more than when they're online. I mean, a lot of the studies show that technologies has given bullies the bigger platform.
And we're going to
now become brave.
We're going to take a look at that in a moment. We are looking at social shaming, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We're going to be back with Melissa Shore and Sue Sheff in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Some stories about social media shaming make your heart hurt. An innocent person, like one of our guests, was targeted by someone seeking revenge for a slight that never actually happened. But sometimes this shame is a racist rant caught on video that went viral. Most people feel differently about these two examples, but should they? Does social media shaming actually make positive change? And if not, then why do it? We're going to taking your calls on this. Do you exercise caution on social media, or are you pretty free about posting? Do you worry that one of your posts could go viral or be used against you in some way? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mornings, there is an S on the end of that. Sue Sheff is a speaker and internet safety advocate, and Melissa Shore is a journalist. They both wrote a book about internet shaming, and they join us this morning. Sue, I want to get back to what we were talking about before the break. You had mentioned something called online disinhibition effect. That's something that says I'm sitting here in front of a keyboard, so I can't see the people that I'm affecting, and I therefore don't feel anything for the people that I'm affecting.
Right. Melissa had mentioned it, but we both wrote about it. Correct.
Okay. So how does it sort of like boost this shaming culture? Because, you know, if I'm standing there and somebody is having an argument and I think it's really funny and I post the argument, I'm not distant from them. I'm standing right there taping them.
You know, the other thing
Yeah, Melissa, you want to take that?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, the other thing I want to mention is because we were talking about the reasons for why people would do this. And I think one thing that really shocked me during the research of this book is that there were actually instances where people have a financial motive to do this, right? And I think that a lot of times we're always talking about why are people mean. A lot of times people are profiting, right? So, I mean, think of we actually talked to the website, people behind the website, People of Walmart. And that was quite a hot site a few years ago, and they even came out with a few books. And that site was basically about going to Walmart, having people take pictures of people they found ridiculous, and posting it for others' amusement. But they were profiting. They were making a lot of money out of that. And, you know, we also found, when I was doing the research, this really shocked me that, you know, those online, you know, YouTube videos that go viral, well, sometimes they don't just go viral because people are clicking on them. There's actually companies whose job it is to sort of see what videos are popping on YouTube, and then what they do is they'll approach the person who took the video and cut a licensing deal or pay them for it, and then they turn around and get it on all the morning shows that we all see. And, you know, some of those are just funny cat videos, and
right.
It's fine. But we had, you know, one example was a woman at an airport who was late, you know, whose flight was delayed, and she had a temper tantrum, was screaming at the flight attendants, and a fellow passenger took out her phone and started filming her. Well, this video went everywhere, and the woman in the video had no say because she didn't own the copyright. She didn't take the video. But the woman who took the video absolutely turned around and sold it to one of these distributors and made money off it. So, I thought that was just a really shocking idea that there was financial incentive to shame you, and you could really you could be helpless to stop it.
So that's interesting. So Sue, you sued and you won, but are there any laws that say the people in the videos, the people shopping at Walmart, the people who may be misbehaving at the airport, have any rights of their own?
I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I know, there aren't. I mean, you should have consent is everything. However, when you're in a public place, I do not believe, and I don't know if you know of any, Melissa, I don't believe that there are any laws out there. It's just like the woman on the plane a few weeks ago. I don't think she has any legal right to have them.
There's no expectation of privacy in a place like Walmart or the plane. Now, the one exception might be the Danny Mathers case, right? So this was in a
locker room.
Oh right, where the woman was shamed in a locker room. Somebody was tweeting about her body type in a locker
Snapchat.
Room.
It was a Snapchat that went out of her in the locker room.
A naked photo of a 71-year-old woman showering in her gym.
Oh. I didn't realize a photo was taken. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. That was terrible. But what we have to remember,
hang on a second. One at a time, Melissa.
Sorry. I was just going to say that in that instance, the woman who filmed it was actually charged with, I believe, a crime, correct, Sue, and was pled guilty?
Invasion of privacy.
Right.
Are there any other instances when somebody might be bullying somebody online? And is that illegal also?
I haven't seen any charges brought up for bullying as of yet. Have you, Melissa? I have not. But I think what a lot of people are doing, too, is they're using bullying in versus activism. Like, when do we draw the line? Like, in other words, people will use the bullying and shaming in the disguise of activism. Like, one of the latest targets that you saw was that Tess Talley, who is the avid hunter out there, and I'm not a big hunter of animals or anything like that, but people were actually sending her death threats and shaming her and all kinds of horrific things online. But at the same time, who are we to judge her and what her hobbies are? And again, I don't believe and I'm not a big animal hunter either, but the threats that she was receiving were just, you know, they were horrible what they were doing to this woman. And it's no different than when we look at the racist ones, the Barbecue Becky or Permit Patty, Pool Patrol Paula, all of these people. Who are we to judge these people? You know, years ago we wouldn't never had the aim and shame concept that we have today, whether you're, and this is offline, when they turn into online consequences.
So here's the question that I have, though, with Barbecue Becky and people who actually did things that I consider to be pretty shameful. Did they change their behavior? Does pointing a camera at them and posting it online make them think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that? And if not, what do you recommend that we do to change this kind of behavior?
I'm not convinced that anything really changed the behavior. What it does is, what I believe it does, what I say about all these stories, is that they're teachable moments reminding us that there is absolutely zero expectation of privacy in our world anymore. And I think even Melissa and I, when we were writing this book, I remember it was around like Christmas time, and I said, you know what, even when I go out shopping, when I'm with a cashier or I'm out to eat, waitress, I am so self-aware of my behavior, even at a stop sign now, because we wrote about Mercedes' mom in our book when she had road rage with some bikers that went by and somebody snapped a picture of her giving the finger. We don't know. I mean, we've all had those moments of just anger. I mean, we're living in a society today where incivility is on the rise. I mean, we have a corrosion of civility online, corrosion of humanity online. It could be any one of us. It's not only about celebrities. We're all targets today. And like I said, our online behavior is an extension of our online reputation today. And your online reputation is the first impression people are going to have of you. So if you're in the job market, or even if you have a job, you are at risk of it hurting your financial future. And that's really the way we have to look at it today. Permit Patty, for example, when she was out, I mean, I get where she was coming from. I honestly don't think that that was a racist sort of taunt. I think it was someone working from home. There was a little girl yelling outside her window. It happened to be, a black little girl. And she probably didn't realize it till she got outside. What she did was completely wrong. And then, of course, our social media blew it up into something bigger than it was.
So this was let me clarify this. This was a little girl who was selling lemonade, who was trying to do fundraiser and selling lemonade outside the apartment complex, and was hawking her wares. And this person, Permit Patty, lived in the apartment complex and yelled at the mother. Because she let her little girl out there and was disturbing her.
Right. Permit Patty went about it the wrong way, completely the wrong. I'm not on Permit Patty's side. I think she should have went out there and talked with the mother and talked with the little girl, but the little girl was shouting outside her window. I don't know if she's selling lemonade or selling water, whatever she was doing. And I don't know if it was fundraising. She was saving up money to go to Disney World.
Right.
Either way, it doesn't matter. Permit Patty did it about the wrong way, but I'm not convinced it was a racist thing. And maybe it was. I don't know, because I don't know Patty, or I think her real name was Allison. I don't know her. And she did resign from her job probably before she got fired from her job. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it seems like
here's the thing, though. What you're describing seems to me maybe a bad thing that might lead to a good thing. I mean, if we're driving down the street and we're not flipping people off because somebody might catch it on camera, then doesn't that lead to maybe more civility and more of us?
It's exactly right.
Okay, talk to me. Okay, Melissa?
Yeah. I would point to one, like, here's a great example of how we can use shaming for good and pressure better public policy than we have. So there was a campaign called Just Drive, and it was run by the federal government, the National Highway and Safety Transportation Administration. But basically, they would call out people on Twitter who were jokingly tweeting that they would text and drive or that they were distracted driving. And it tried to basically send them a little message: it's not okay to text and drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they would call them out by name on their Twitter account. And is that shaming for good? I mean, I definitely think it could be a good example of that.
You guys wrote about a Stanford study that found that when someone is actually bombarded with negative online comments, people start to feel sorry for them.
That's a new study that just came out today or a couple of days ago. Yes, we wrote about a study that every one of us are capable of being a troll. I mean, trolls aren't like what everyone thinks they are, just people huddling in their home, eating chips all day and being mean to each other. Trolls could be any one of us waking up at the wrong side of the bed, having a bad day. You get your fingers to the keyboard and you just want to sprue. You know, again, we're living in this contentious world today. And you don't have to look any further than back to the politics of 2016, and you saw what adults were doing, just slamming each other and without acting, you know, maturely. You know, we can be constructive. We don't have to be combative. So I just believe,
We'll follow up on that in a moment. We can be constructive. We don't have to be combative. We are talking about social media shaming here on this hour of The Morning Show. We're going to be back in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about social media shaming and asking if it ever works. We're also exploring why our society likes to traffic in shame and outrage rather than listening and understanding. What do you think? We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. Have you ever been shamed online? Have you ever shamed someone and do you now regret it? 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org is the email, or you could tweet us. You could tweet us and ask a question or make a comment, but don't shame anybody at WPR Mornings. Chris from Adams, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I was pretty heavily shamed by a guy. We were having a discussion. It was on the 1A show on National Public Radio, and we were having a discussion about sexual harassment in higher education. Mind you, there have been some pretty good stories about this, in the media.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, and I have some experience having dealt with situations at the University of Wisconsin system and have some pretty big guns standing behind what I did. And this guy just came after me. He went and looked up every single thing about about the case. He baited me. He took it online, and then he started calling me names. The F word was used. The B word was used. He just went out there and just, you know, just tried to take me down. And just yesterday, because they're doing a series this week on education, I posted something, and he came after me again and tried to bait me again into a situation, and I just shut him down. I just said, I'm not talking to you anymore.
And did he go away?
Pardon me?
And did he go away?
I don't know. He hasn't responded to that at all. But see, these people get off on it. I mean, right. This is what they do. They have no lives. This is what they do.
So if you complained, I don't know if it was 1A or whatever the show. If you complained to that show, have you tried to complain to that show?
I haven't tried to complain to that show. I'm more interested right now in them picking up this issue and doing a show about sexual harassment in higher education. Hmm. I mean, we have some big cases out there. There's Penn State, there's Michigan State, there's Ohio State. And I've been trying to deal with the University of Wisconsin system for 33 years. This system is just as bad as all of those other places. And it's ripe for something horrible like that being exposed. And it's not in anybody's interest for that to happen. We've been trying to pick away at getting them to deal with it, and they absolutely will not. And this guy just tried to destroy me as being the bad person in this situation, and I'm not. Not that I want that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Chris. Melissa, Chris was talking about sexual harassment in higher education, but there's also sexual harassment online. Do you find that most of the victims of this are disproportionately female?
Yes. I mean, that is absolutely the case. Can I just offer Chris one piece of advice?
Yes.
So this is a bit counterintuitive, because I think when we encounter a troll online and they start writing horrible things about us or to us, you know, your impulse is to just delete it, and you don't want to see it, and it's very upsetting. One thing that Sue advocates and has taught us all is that if you're ever going to need to build a case down the line, you want to actually document those things. So she should be screenshotting and actually saving somewhere on her computer history of everything she's receiving from this person, just in case she needs it later to back her story up. And to, you know, if she ever needed to approach any of the platforms to get things removed, she's going to need that good documentation.
So she can't just say, this guy slut-shamed me. She has to say, this guy did this, and provide them with all of the answers that he gave her, all of the things that he said.
Right. And, I mean, she didn't talk about what platforms he was doing it on, but obviously there's ways. I mean, the technology has given us some ways now to block someone, to mute someone, to report someone. So you should be persistent in using whatever method you can to let them know.
Okay, we are taking calls. Chris in Middleton, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I think you've got two impulses or traditions feeding into the modern situation. One is the Rodney King episode in 1992, or 91, I believe, have taught people that in police interactions to get their cell phones out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been generally positive. It doesn't give context, obviously. You can't have full context, but it does. It is very important information. The other is the age of Jerry Springer. That right now we do love to boo. And I was disturbed when Barack Obama appeared here, and he kept giving boo lines. And of course now that's rampant with the current administration. So we seem to be, we seem to be wanting our professional wrestling things, but we also want justice. And I think you get both. I'm not completely convinced that the kind of shaming you're talking about is fully negative.
Thank you for that, Chris. You know, there have been a number of incidences in the last few years where cops have been shown to be doing something wrong, and that has gone viral. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
Oh, I believe that there's always a good side, and you always have to have the pros and the cons. And how many times have we used the video? It's no different than what we saw a few weeks ago with the parent shaming, with the coach that's out there videotaping parents on the sports field and showing them how they're acting. And it's just a kid's soccer game. I mean, I believe there are the pros and cons, and that's exactly what Melissa was just talking about with the calling out people that are texting and driving. As someone that works closely with AT&T with the Ick and Wait campaign, we know the statistics of more and more car accidents that are killing people from distracted driving. So, I mean, I think that there is definitely a positive side. And if your child was a victim of police brutality, or if you're a parent out there that you're watching these other parents act like foolishly on the field, it's nice that somebody is actually, you know, taking a snapshot of them or a video of them and say, hey, this is the way you're acting. You are supposed to be the role model for our next generation. You're supposed to be leading by example for your own child. If you don't want your child to be a bully or a cyber bully, why are you acting this way? Because a lot of parents don't even realize their behavior until they see it on the big screen, the big screen being the palm of their hand and their smartphone.
So it's not necessarily, it is something that we can use as a learning tool. I mean, it can be argued that even calling out racists and who then lose their job, which is kind of disturbing, that teaches, it may not do anything for them, but it teaches maybe the rest of us that, it's not good to go in and say everybody should start speaking English in this restaurant. And even if it's just, I may get publicly shamed for it rather than I now have a multicultural outlook. It doesn't matter. It still changes our behavior in society. Melissa, can you talk to me about that?
I think in theory you're right, but I just think we have to be careful about who decides. So many of these situations are really ambiguous. The person, the mob watching on the other end of the screen doesn't get all the context, and the person making the judgment call also may not have all the information. It's sort of this slippery slope, isn't it? I mean, do you really want to risk your individual reputation and sacrifice it on the altar of everyone learning a lesson if you were called out unfairly? I'm just not sure.
So what do we do? Give me a prescription for the future, Melissa.
Well, I think, for one, I think the thing that Sue and I were shocked to find at the end is that as much as we love shaming people, there are a lot of people out there that just can't be shamed. And we almost thought we should do a follow-up called Shameless Nation, because so many people are doing crazy things and they seem to have no shame about it. And we've seen, you know, videos go out, girls sexting other, students and feeling no compulsions about, having those images of themselves out there forever. Mm-hmm. I would certainly point to our leader in the land doesn't seem to have any, ability to be shamed for some of the things that are put out there on Twitter. So I don't know. You can't really shame somebody if they refuse to be shamed.
That's an interesting point. Kim Kardashian is famous now because she put out a sex tape.
Right.
Those
started, right, Paris Hilton, all the sex tape. I mean, so to some degree, I think shameless people have it going on. They know how to dodge our whole bullet here.
That is something that we need to explore in the future. I appreciate that. You just heard from Melissa Shore. She's a journalist. She co-authored the book Shame Nation. She co-authored it with Sue Sheff, who is a speaker, internet safety advocate, and who has been shamed herself and won a lawsuit about that. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
I'm Carrie Kaufman, and it's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.